BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan, with me Brian Fernandez, and the week restarts, as it were, after a one-day break. Wishing everybody a happy Deepavali. We didn't wish you enough on Tuesday before it happened, because we weren't on air yesterday, we just had lots of lovely music. Brian, did you have a good time this midweek break?
Yeah, actually, I just went over to Johor, caught up with my folks and stuff like that.
All the way to Johor Bahru?
Yeah, just had a meeting and stuff and caught up with my folks and a friend, and so it was good.
Okay. I got a lot of greetings. A lot of people wished me happy Deepavali, though I'm not, I'm not Hindu, though I have a part Hindu heritage, part Catholic heritage, and I'm decidedly unreligious, but I accepted all of them. Though I know that some people, looking at Twitter, found this annoying, saying that a lot of other Malaysians kind of assume that if you're Indian, you must celebrate Deepavali. Don't know the difference between the cultural, religious, and other kind of identity issues and how complex it is. I just don't expect people deal with my complexity. So I just got to say thank you very much, and same to you.
Yeah, I will say that. I mean, we are Malaysians. I celebrate all the festivals, literally. So, when someone says, okay, happy Deepavali, I'll say, yes, thank you very much, but I'm actually Catholic.
So. Oh, you do make actually do correct them. Yeah. Oh, I never do. I just go for the thank you very much and same to you. Now, as we had a 24-hour break, because a lot of news, I'll just give you some of them. The Philippine military believes that Malaysia's most wanted terrorist, Mahmud Ahmad, is still in Marawi City following the death of the Abu Saif leader. He's expected to take over. He, of course, is got his PhD from a Malaysian university and taught at University of Malaya. So, wonderful stuff there. Clearly a man who believes in practical things rather than just
academic.
Absolutely. He's not just thinking of the revolution, he's going to actually lead it.
I don't think that's something that University of Malaya wants to be associated with. But
well, I'm afraid in this case they have no choice. Okay, the United Nations is ready to get into the Syrian city of Raqqa after the so-called Islamic State was driven out. They held that city for almost 3 years. So in the battle against Islamic State, this is a major victory, though. Ideologies can't be bombed out of existence because they exist in people's heads on there. Also in the news, MACC Chief Commissioner Zulkifli Ahmad said that he will not give in to pressure from personal attacks or continue his duties without fear of favour. This goes following that video.
Yeah, and MACC, of course, I think he has done a very good job under his leadership, and it's good that he's taken that stand that he's going to carry on despite all the personal attacks.
On the broader global stage, China has entered a new era, says its President Xi Jinping at the Communist Party's 19th Congress. This is, of course, a very important Congress in terms of choosing leaders, also setting agendas. And as we heard on Tuesday, the question of whether Xi Jinping is going to be elevated to the status of a Mao Zedong or a Deng Xiaoping in terms of his own articulation of, the official Communist Party ideology. So all that, we're going to try and bring you some analysis of that tomorrow. So stay tuned for that. We're coming up. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Saint-Tropez by Pink Floyd, a very mellow Pink Floyd. I'm sure it couldn't. With me, Brian Fernandez. Before we get on to the next topic, Brian, just a quick look at a poll that we put out. We ask, do you invest in bonds? And the options are yes, I'd like to, but not sure. No, I'm not interested. At this point in time, 22% say yes, they invest in bonds. 56% say I'd like to, but I'm not sure. And 22% say I'm not interested. Now, if you're part of that 60% who says I'd like to, but not interested, at 7:55 a.m. this morning, you can learn more about investing in bonds on the 9th episode of the Invest Smart series. So look forward to that. That's 7:55 a.m. in the morning. You can learn more about it so that you can invest in bonds. And if you already invest in bonds, perhaps something you might pick up a tip or two. So look forward to that. Now, back to the question of leadership. That's always there in the air, especially as we come into the long or short run, we don't know, towards the next general elections.
Yeah, so again, are we really adequately prepared for leadership roles? So that's this article in the BBC that talks about the 10 biggest misconceptions of being a leader. And one of the things is, for many people, taking up their first management or leadership role, they're pretty much thrust upon it. I mean, you've worked very hard to be a leader.
So leadership roles have been thrust upon these people.
Absolutely. So for example,
like greatness.
Not so much greatness. Then there's two aspects of it. One aspect is perhaps leadership role when you take your first CEO role, for example. And that's a whole different category altogether. But one category is also your first management role, the first role where you start to be responsible for other people other than yourself in your organization.
But what about the, you know, things that happen before you enter, you know, the working world, or, you know, things that happen at school, for instance, becoming a school prefect? I remember, you know, having greatness thrust upon me by my teacher, who says, "I'm going to nominate you to be a school prefect." And I said,
"Or
no."
Or class monitor.
And I didn't want it. I didn't want it. He was very disappointed. I said, "No, thank you very much. I don't want to be policing my friends," because I wasn't so articulate. I just said, "No, I don't want to do that." Probably the biggest mistake of my life, in the sense that I could have learned so much about the way in which people actually operate. Because I think the most annoying thing about leadership is that you have to lead people.
Yeah, well, that's if you don't like people. But I mean, something like me, I enjoy interacting with people. I I'm a people person in general.
And you've had greatness thrust upon you.
I wouldn't call it that. I wouldn't put it in such a high pedestal. But really, I think, and you've got a very good point. When you're in school, if you take part in those sort of extracurricular activities, that helps build your, those serve as basic building blocks for leadership skills.
Yeah, so you think of all the, you know, the group, the clubs, you know, and it's a kind of a training ground for a lot of young people in terms of leadership, because these clubs have hierarchies. I mean, some people who are much more have some sort of antipathy towards this kind of hierarchical notion of society might say, well, this is the building blocks for kind of a social fascism that we're all going to be introduced to later on in a much more broader canvas. But surely, yeah, you're right. I mean, they are the building blocks, because these clubs and associations all have hierarchies, and kids start to elect each other, and, you know, and people have power.
Absolutely. And you would find that, you know, a lot of times when people are, for example, large organizations in particular, when they're recruiting for top talent, say for their management trainee programs, one of the things that they would actually look for is really people who've got a strong base of extracurricular activities when they were in university or in schools. And this is beyond their academic credentials. But a lot of times, Sharad, also, when you take your first management job, I remember that I struggled in my first, I became a manager at about 26, pretty young age. And it was really hard because no one told me what to do. I had to act as a manager all of a sudden, managing people who were my peers just like the day before. So that was actually quite a challenge.
Okay, so in this article from the BBC has looked at different aspects of the question of leadership, and they talk about myths that need to be unraveled. And let me begin with one of my favorite ones. It's tough at the top. Bosses have more autonomy, better pay, drivers, personal assistants, business class travel, nice hotels, and they get deference from their colleagues. This is not a tough existence. It's much tougher lower down. Bosses should never forget that. Now, so they're saying that that's a myth, it's not so great on the top.
It is not, because one of the things is also people don't realize, and let's talk about CEO roles. You've got to make very tough decisions, and often against your personal beliefs, for the benefit of the organization. So it's not, if you
have, so it's a lonely existence.
It's a very lonely existence. So let me give you an example. You've taken over a new job and you've been promoted from, say, the chief financial officer to the CEO, and you've got to cut 2,000 jobs in a company, and they're all your friends. How would you feel about that?
Tough stuff. So anyway, they're 10 myths to look at. Tell us what you think. You can tweet us at BFM Radio, or you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 and join the conversation. Remember also, there's a Twitter poll on bonds. Do you invest in bonds? Yes, no, and I'd like to, but I want to know more about it. And of course, you can at 7:55 a.m. today on the 9th episode of the InvestSmart series. Stay tuned. We'll be back. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, The Style Council and Shout to the Top. I'm Sharad Kutan, with me Brian Fernandez. It's coming up to 20 minutes past 6, and of course it's the 19th of October. We've been talking about leadership and of course the shock departure of the CEO of Malaysian Airlines. Is part of that story about leadership. I think there's some discussion, some conversations going on about the nature of his departure. Why wasn't it that Malaysian Airlines was aware of this? They seem to have gotten the news from Ryanair, and it's in a notice it sent out. And so there's some confusion as to it. I mean, Brian, what's your understanding of Peter Bellew's departure and also decision to join Ryanair?
Well, from what we read from press reports, Ryanair actually put up a statement first, and then Malaysian Airlines people had to scramble to then come up with a response to that. And Peter Bellew then put a personal statement out that he was indeed leaving Malaysian Airlines. Now, from a exit perspective, probably not an ideal situation by any standard.
But what does it suggest, right? If Peter Bellew, and he's come out to say that, there was no interference in his leadership and all was, apparently hunky-dory, why would he leave in this way? Why wouldn't he, serve out his term? Why didn't he inform the board beforehand? I mean, if you have a good relationship, surely you want to leave on a good note, and that cannot be by having a shock departure.
Yeah, and especially if you're a senior management person, normally your contract would state you probably have a 6 to 12 months exit clause. Well,
as long as 12 months.
Yeah, because what may happen is you go through a period of gardening leave, especially because the company you may be privy to certain secrets, so which are trade secrets.
Like the secrets of Malaysian Airlines success. He's going to be taking it to Ryanair.
So what
they're going to run Ryanair like they'd run Malaysian Airlines all these decades.
Well, I don't know about that. But basically, that's a normal thing with senior management roles. So you have a period of either a notice period or some call it gardening leave. So especially in sensitive technical positions, when you're involved in technology, you have a longer grade. So the company continues to pay you even though you have left the company, but you're not allowed to do any work for anybody else.
Well, if you were going to hire Peter Bellew and you looked at his CV and you looked at the history of his previous departure, in this case, Malaysian Airlines, would you say, well, that wasn't a good thing to do? And would it be a mark against him?
I think it's always important, whether you're a CEO or whether you're an executive with 6 months of experience, when you're leaving any organization, the important tenet to remember is don't burn bridges. Because I think that's a critical thing that somebody needs to manage their career.
But what about just being honest, right? So when you leave an organization, the media comes up to you and say, was there interference? Were there problems within the organization? What's your first responsibility as a leader or somebody protecting their own professional turf? Is it to kind of plaster over the problems or is it to be honest with the public?
I think in general, what people tend to do is do the politically correct thing, which is say that everything is hunky-dory. It's good for both sides as well, even though perhaps behind the scenes the whole atmosphere and the relationships may be completely different.
So with Peter Bellew leaving in this particular way, does it in fact raise flags? I mean, if people are skeptical by his the statements that he's made that everything was fine and he's never, he didn't actually face any kind of interference. But because he departed in such a way, it seems to undermine precisely this kind of rosy picture that he paints, doesn't it?
Malaysian Airlines has had 3 CEOs in 3 years. So I think I think it calls into question really a lot of things about Malaysian
so
Airlines.
Is he being irresponsible? I mean, you know, he signs up for the job. The job has a particular tenure. He knows that in order to turn, I mean, he's supposed to be some sort of turnaround king, right? You know, that it takes time. And so the fact that he's kind of bailed on it, I mean, he's noted what, Irish nationalism? Did he raise that issue? I mean, whatever it is that can't be argued against, I mean, is it irresponsible for somebody to take on a senior position like this and then bail before even the first term is up?
You see, it's not irresponsible, especially perhaps if you've been told something, you've been set a charter in terms of this is your goalpost, this is what you need to do, you've got a sandbox done for you, and you're not allowed to do perhaps what you were supposed to do or what you were promised that you would be able to do. As a senior management person, you have options. You have options to go elsewhere. And perhaps in this case, that's exactly what happened.
So was he being irresponsible?
No, I don't think so.
So his primary responsibility is to himself, not to the companies that have hired him.
You see, so there's a lot of background stuff that we don't know about. Was there really interference? So if I'm a leader and I chart a certain direction and my board tells me to do something else and I don't believe in it, I shouldn't be executing that strategy that was not mine.
Okay, so he's protecting his professional integrity. Well, it's interesting. We don't know what the truth is, and maybe we'll have to wait for the Peter Bellew,
right now,
the autobiography, to find out when he looks back, you know, over 50 years and reminisces about his time in Malaysia. At this point in time, all I can say is, you know, maybe the thing is to buy bonds. No, I don't mean that. If you invest in bonds, why don't you join our Twitter poll? So far, 19% say they do invest in bonds. 71% say I'd like to, but I'm not sure. I don't have enough information. Remember, at 7:55 a.m., we'll be having the 9th episode in the Invest Smart series to inform you on just that. Coming up and taking us all the way up to the first bulletin of the morning, Still Sound by Toro Y Moi. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was No Rain by Blind Melon. Brian Fernandez and myself, Sherrod Kutin. It's coming up to 40 minutes past 6 on the 19th of October. Yesterday, Tan Sri Yeo Tiong Lei passed away at the age of 87 because leaving behind a major legacy, which we'll be talking about later on. Also to note, at this point in time, we have a poll going, and this is related to our Invest Smart series, and you're going to be listening to that at 7:55 this morning. And we talk about bonds. We ask you, are you invested in bonds? Have you made that investment already? Or have you not? And if you'd like to. And thus far, the numbers coming in, we have, 76% say I'd like to, but I'm not sure about them. So stay tuned for that 7:55 Invest Smart episode. Now, time to look at what Malaysians are actually doing. Netflix. Apparently, we are one of the top in terms of binge-watching television series in Malaysia. Sorry, in Asia. So Malaysians, top in Asia when it comes to binge-watching. Is that good or bad is the question before us.
Well, the thing is, okay, so let me look at me as a very unusual example. I don't watch TV anymore except for football, and I consume news basically via the internet. I gave up an Astro subscription, I think, sometime last year. But from a viewing patterns, I like to watch series in binges, probably like maybe 6 or 7 episodes at a time. Because what it does, it actually enhances the whole enjoyment of the series because you could follow it, you know, quite chronologically, because episode by episode. I enjoy that, but I think that, you know, perhaps you have a different take because you love watching TV, don't you?
You know, I used to be a TV addict. I stopped for decades, and then only recently have I started, you know, watching TV. And I mean, by TV, I mean things like, you know, made-for-TV shows, series. which you can binge watch. I grew up at a time where you couldn't binge watch because you'd have to wait a week before the next episode. And those days, we had the skill of remembering the facts of the previous episode, even if you didn't have that trailer that, you know, did a quick catch up on what happened last time. We actually had the capacity. Maybe we're breeding a generation of human beings that, you know, have short memories, and so they can't wait a week between each episode and remember which character is which. Is that a skill that's now depleted?
Sure, I think that's a very cynical view on it.
Oh, really?
But the reality, the reality is, I think it enhances your enjoyment because you can watch everything.
And you can remember who Jon Snow is from episode to episode.
Well, especially, and to give you a very good example, I think the last episodes I think that I watched as a, you know, binge watching was actually Game of Thrones. And that, because that's quite a complex story, I think it really enhanced the enjoyment because I was able to
watch it. You can't defer gratification. That's your problem. Yeah. And that's my problem too. Today, when I watch, you know, Game of Thrones, I watch the whole thing, all the episodes all at once. Or another notable one was The Night Of, which I thought was with, you know, which was brilliant. I think it was Reza Aziz. He won an Oscar recently. An Emmy, I think, recently. But, you know, I must say, I leave the end of that series thinking, oh my goodness, I'm done now. I can't, there is going to be no more Game of Thrones until the next season. And instead of, you know, spreading out my pleasures, I've had them concentrated. And I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing.
Well, it really depends on you as an individual. I mean, how do you look at this as entertainment? I tend to watch them, say, in 5 or 6 episodes at a time.
They come in about that, right? Yeah. So they usually for a season, it could be for everything from 8 to 13 or 12 episodes for a season, yeah.
Yeah, so that ends up being split maybe over a week or a week and a half, because when you see everything in sequence. And I think that spending, say, 13 hours in front of the TV is utterly nonsense. Maybe 5 or 6 hours is the most I could take. But it's also, don't forget, it's also cheap entertainment. You get a few friends over and you watch it together. It's quite fun that way.
Okay, so we have some experts weighing in this very quickly. An expert in neuroscience from the University of Melbourne said binge watchers actually remember less about a particular show than those who've slept between episodes. And it's also said, and this is from another study from the University of Queensland, that says those who watch 5 hours or less of TV a week have better health outcomes than those who spend more than 30 hours watching TV. Well, there you have it. The experts have spoken. Maybe binge watching isn't
great for your health.
Great for your health, or even for your memory, or even your pleasure of a show. So all that, we'll be back with more conversations. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. The soothing sounds of Aretha Franklin, Daydreaming. We expect you not to be daydreaming while you drive to work or drive your kids to school this morning. I'm going to keep you alive and alert by, you know, engaging in some mental gymnastics. Anyway, Brian, what we have that story and that, that tragedy in Somalia. Yeah.
Yeah, so last Saturday there was a massive explosion that rocked Mogadishu, the capital of Somalia. As of yesterday, the death toll was about 300 people. It topped 300 people, and an estimated 500 people were actually injured. No claim of responsibility, but the Somalian government officials and terrorism experts believe that Al-Shabaab militants were behind the explosion. But interestingly enough, Sharad, unlike other terrorist attacks in the West, global media coverage of this attack was very scant in comparison.
Now, yeah, you know, sometimes you even have, you know, the death of a single person in the West will, you know, will take up a lot of TV time, will take up reams of columns in newspapers, all of which, you know, often related to larger themes of attack on a democracy or liberty and such. Now, the question of why, and this is not even a new story, of why it is that so much of this kind of news coming from, the same sort of news, coming from the third world, just becomes a drop in the ocean. It's almost like, well, this was expected to happen, and so it rates very little coverage. coverage.
No, so, Sharad, what frustrates me is really this. You know, it's as if that a Western life is worth a lot more than an African life or an Asian life or something like that. And it upsets me because it's these 300 people or say 800 people, if you look at the bigger numbers in terms of the injured, are insignificant in comparison.
Well, so I think, that's a conclusion that a lot of us draw from this lopsided coverage. I was looking at this story on Al Jazeera. I follow Al Jazeera on Twitter, and they have a little video about some of the victims. And one of them was a human rights activist. Another was a woman, a technocrat, who was said to be, very young woman, who was said to be up and coming in her field. Another was an older man, maybe in early 40s, just come back from Minnesota. He leaves behind, a wife and three children. And the humanizing of the Mogadishu bombing story is so important and always happens with people when terrorist attacks in the West, But of course, with the 3,000 or so people who have died, say, from drone attacks by the U.S., they are just anonymous. And this seems to be the fate of the people of the Third World when it comes to the media. And I'm wondering about our own media, whether we also indulge in this or we also have our lapses, as it were.
But so, Sharad, what do you suggest? How do we change this?
Well, I don't know if it's so easily changed, because I think one of the things that editors here will be saying to themselves is, do our readers or listeners or viewers really care about this part of the world? And if they don't, then really it doesn't rate very highly. The question, of course, is can you change that? Can you make people care about people in Mogadishu if you've never covered Mogadishu in any other way? So if suddenly Mogadishu comes out, people will be saying, where is this in the world? Where's a Paris or New York or even, a Melbourne rate more highly or much more visible, because we have multiple views of those places. And so when something happens in Melbourne, people will be saying, well, I went there for a holiday. Or if something happened in Paris, well, I was planning to go to, for a holiday in Paris.
But that's a small number in Malaysia, Sharad. So maybe, and I have an...
for the aspirational middle classes. I mean, for the aspirational middle classes, a Melbourne, a New York, a London. I mean, we talk about England as if it was, the 15th state of the Federation. And people, really, I mean, Malaysian politicians are always going there. They all probably have homes in London too.
Absolutely.
Right?
But you see, Sharad, actually, I beg to differ. Actually, there is a bigger opportunity for media to cover this sort of stories differently. The whole media industry is facing disruption. So one of the key things that they could differentiate themselves is by having original content and perhaps focusing on these sort of events that the Western media kind of largely ignores. That could be positive aspect of how we could turn this around.
So you think of Al Jazeera, right? So I follow Al Jazeera and I watch Al Jazeera precisely because I think the editorial line is slightly different from the big, Western sort of centered or Western centric media organizations like the BBC and CNN and such. But but then who's got time to look at so many different outlets? You tend to choose one that you think coheres with your own sense of the world. I think Al Jazeera, is amazing and does precisely what you're saying should be done. We'll be back for more after this. We're coming up to the news shortly and then more news and analysis. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez, and we're bringing you more news and analysis. All throughout the morning, it's coming up to 7 minutes past seven, actually it's just past 6 minutes past seven, to be more precise. It's the 19th of October, because Thursday, we've just come back from a short midweek break. Happy Deepavali for those of you who are still celebrating it. Now, also, we have a Twitter poll, Brian, and this has got to do with bonds. And we ask the simple questions, do you invest in bonds? The options are yes and no, I'm not interested. I'd like to, but I'm not sure. Thus far, 75% of you say, I'd like to, but not sure. So if you like to, not sure about what a bond is and, what kind of asset class it is and if this is a good deal, you can listen to the 9th episode of the InvestSmart series today at 7:55 a.m. So all that coming up. Brian, have you invested in bonds before?
No, I've never. I've always thought that bonds were something that only institutionals invested in. Until very recently, probably around last year, when I realized that actually it's much more prevalent than I imagine, especially not outside of Malaysia. In Singapore, for example, there was a number of people who were investing in bonds.
Okay. Until recently, I thought a bond was a relationship I had with my mother. Okay. Earlier this week, the Malaysian AIDS Council, MAC, condemned fear-mongering against the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community through recent media reports linking them to HIV infections. The MAC was referring to a Malaysia Kini video published last Friday. It quoted an officer from JAKIM, the Federal Islamic Development Agency, said that LGBT community were the main contributors to the spread of HIV. Now, here's a snippet from that video.
Dalam konteks ni, kita boleh merujuklah kepada dapatan-dapatan daripada kajian KKM tu, Kementerian Kesihatan. So memang yang latest, yang terkini, memang kalau kita tengok quote daripada Free Mission Today pun, 60% hari ni among the homosexual and bisexual. So they should alarm the LGBT supporters group.
So that was an excerpt from a Malaysia Kini video where a JAKIM official drew attention to AIDS transmission statistics now showing that they're greatest among, at least in terms of growth, among those who are homosexual or bisexual. According to the MAC, the Malaysian AIDS Council, over 3,000 new infections last year, 46% were through homosexual and bisexual behaviour or contact, 38% through heterosexual transmission. Where it's gone down, of course, Brian, is in transmission through intravenous drug use. That used to be the biggest group. Now, according to the MAC, community-friendly measures and stigma reduction efforts have encouraged groups to come forward for HIV screening and treatment. But homophobia, transphobia, and fear-mongering against the LGBT community threaten to stem progress in terms of our national goals to end the AIDS scourge by 2030. Now, a while ago, the Evening Editions team spoke to Dr. Chris Beyer, Professor of Epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the immediate past president of the International AIDS Society. One of the things he talked about was how stigma and discrimination against the LGBT community enables the spread of HIV. Here he is talking about men who have sex with men as a group, a target group, in terms of the eradication of or the reduction in transmission of the HIV virus.
Across this region, but actually it's also true globally. It's true in my country, in the U.S., but we're really seeing this in Malaysia, in Thailand, in China, substantially, that there is a ongoing epidemic among young men who have sex with men, young gay and bisexual men. Now, this is a population that has a number of specific vulnerabilities to HIV. A lot of that is just biological. It's just because of the way the virus is spread. But it's also the case that the lack of, for example, relevant sexual health education for those communities is a real barrier. The stigma and the discrimination, in many cases, the legal sanction, the criminalization of same-sex behavior, has further marginalized those communities.
We also asked Dr. Breyer what is needed to alleviate and eliminate the spread of AIDS amongst the gay community.
What these young men need is, first of all, access to quality information that's relevant to help them protect themselves. Secondly, they need to be able to access HIV testing and treatment if they're living with HIV in settings where they are not going to be stigmatized, discriminated, or harassed by the authorities. That is extremely important. We have seen that where you can really provide those kinds of services and treat the men living with HIV, you can have enormous impacts.
That was Dr. Chris Breyer, immediate past president of the International AIDS Society. You can listen to the full interview on our BFM app, and that's available on the Apple App Store and on Google Play. Now, coming back to the question of, you know, accepting difference, and I think this is where, you know, is the base of this. We have recent news coming from Greece, the Greek government there, going to pass a law that would help people with, you know, gender identity issues, and where, in fact, gender identity is not clear and such, and because this is a reference to the transgendered community. And there's pushback from the Orthodox Church there. And, you know, always this kind of news always makes me wonder what it is that prevents some segments of society from accepting individuals and communities that have long existed in their midst, you know, who maybe don't conform to their ideology, what the perfect world is, but who are a fact of society and fact of history. That exclusion leads to abuse, marginalization, and just not good for society. And yet, the Orthodox Church there is dead set against it.
You know, unfortunately, Sharad, that's an unfortunate consequence of people being generally very, very conservative, and anything that's different or slightly above the norm is stigmatized. And the, from a public health and safety issue, I think the issues that Dr. Chris Breyer brought up are very, very important, because if they can't get the community is stigmatized, they're not going to come forward and get the necessary help, counseling and assistance to prevent them of this health issues from spreading.
So, in fact, that lesson that we've learned for the decades of in AIDS prevention, in fact, with a lot of diseases and a lot of issues that have in society, more openness, more acceptance leads to solutions, right? That is something that everybody knows. So it's not like those representing these institutions don't know it. Is it that they don't care? They don't care to know it. They don't care to have it in public policy. And I think sometimes, you know, the conservatism is, I mean, that's just a label we put on other people, but it's also, it's turf, you know. They're protecting their territory. They would not concede these things because they think it diminishes their influence in society, and that's why they oppose it.
But it's also, Sharad, it's a consequence of you as or largely as individuals opening your mindset. So 25 years ago, I can tell you that I had very much more conservative views on the gay and lesbian community. Unfortunately, I was one of those people who used to make fun of people. My views are completely different today. I've evolved with the times. And I think that's the, and that part of that is also education, exposure and experience. So that's something that perhaps the community as a whole or leaders in the community should try to then address, trying to educate the larger community as a whole that, you know, essentially everybody's pretty much the same, just slightly different in terms of your preferences and leanings.
Yeah, and we should celebrate difference. Yeah. Well, after all, KL is a city of diversity, we're told.
Absolutely.
At least well, that's what they say on the billboards. We'll be back with more and news and analysis. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.